Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for June 25th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, engineered lung tissue, the uncertainty in extracting natural gas from shale, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about chimpanzees killing for land, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
For the first time, scientists have engineered lung tissue, implanted it, and measured it, exchanging carbon dioxide with oxygen.
You know, I think in some ways this paper can be a little bit confusing because it's a little bit like we're taking intact lungs and we're taking the cells away and then we're putting the cells back, and what's the whole point?
Laura Nicholson at Yale University, a senior author of a paper published online by Science, reporting the work.
And I think the whole point of the paper is that we wanted to develop a scientific and technological platform for eventually regenerating autologous lungs.
Or lungs that are derived from the cells of the patient who needs better lung function to live.
And I think this is possible. I honestly view this as a 20 or 25 year problem.
With the advantage, compared to the current therapy of a lung transplant, being that the patient's body won't reject the autologous regenerated lung because it is derived from the patient's own cells. But so far,
this is far from a perfect lung.
Peter Lalkish researches tissue engineering at Drexel University and is not associated with the study.
But this is the first step that they can show that this is in principle feasible, and this is why this is such a groundbreaking paper.
What Nicholson and her team did was to remove a lung from a rat and then carefully wash away all the lung cells. That left behind only the extracellular lung matrix, a very intricate three-dimensional structure made up of protein.
The microarchitecture of lung is extraordinarily complex. In our lungs, in our body, there's some 70 square meters of surface area that is used for gas exchange. So the insight that we could basically fall back on a native lung and use that as a scaffolding that has all the right structure, but then eventually repopulate it with cells from the patient to produce a lung that would be not rejected by the patient, I think that was the initial insight that started our work on this topic 4 years ago.
The next step was to find the right cells to repopulate the extracellular lung matrix of the patient, in this case, the rat. And these cells came from other rats, neonatal rats.
When we repopulated the epithelial compartment of the lung, so the airway compartment of the lung, we injected a combination of cell types. Actually, there were 7 or 8 different cell types in the mixture that we injected. And when we began these studies several years ago, I expected the cell repopulation to be random. But we were surprised to find that in most cases, the cells went to the proper locations. So airway cells went to airways, and alveolar cells, which are the alveoli or the air sacs of the lung, alveolar cells went to alveoli. So there was clearly some cues that were offered by the lung matrix that really dictated where cells landed and who they became once they landed there.
Finally, the last step was to put the extracellular lung matrix that was injected with the neonatal rat cells into a bioreactor that Nicholson and her team designed to regenerate the lung tissue.
When lungs are developing in the fetus, in the womb, the lungs are perfused with blood through their vasculature. And it's also important to know that the fetus actually breathes in utero. So the fetus breathes amniotic fluid in and out intermittently during development, and this is actually fairly important for lung development. We mimicked both of those things, both the blood circulation and the breathing of fluid, in our bioreactor.
1 week later, they had a new lung fit for a rat, which they implanted into a rat and measured the lung exchanging carbon dioxide with oxygen about 95% as efficiently as a normal healthy lung. Again, Peter Lalkish of Drexel University.
So this is one step further than other people have done, who just have shown that you can replenish, reseed a lung, and then get tissue-specific distribution of the cells. Here they matured the lung, and could show functionality, which is gas exchange, which is the ultimate functionality, gas exchange.
But only for a couple of hours. Again, study author Laura Nicholson.
After a few hours, gradually some of the blood vessels in the engineered lung began to clot off. And so I think that there were some exposed areas of blood vessels that were not completely coated with endothelium,
which is needed for a blood vessel to remain open and not clot.
So that's clearly something that we need to work on iteratively moving forward.
And there are other problems, too, that Nicholson describes as technological. That is, she thinks they are problems that can be solved with time and effort. But Nicholson says the more fundamental problem is where those patient-specific cells come from to repopulate the extracellular lung matrix. With rats, her team used cells from young rat pups. For humans, Nicholson says, they'll need stem cells, perhaps induced pluripotent stem cells.
And to coax that cell to differentiate into the different lineages of lung that are needed to repopulate the entire lung tissue, and then to control those cells once they go into the lung matrix and to make sure they don't change their mind and become somebody else, which is a problem with very primitive stem cells. Occasionally they're hard to control. So in terms of sort of fundamental scientific advances that need to happen before this can be a clinical reality, I think that the fundamental work has to do with controlling the differentiation and the ultimate fate of autologous stem cells.
So again, this is the 20 to 25 years Nicholson thinks it will take before we see this kind of lung regeneration in a clinical setting. But Peter Lelkish of Drexel University doesn't think it will take that long.
I congratulate Laura Nicholson for being so cautious and not overhyping the situation. Because other people would go and tell, oh, we do it tomorrow. No, she is very cautious, and I think this is the right approach to do, to be cautious, to see what can be done, but not to hype it and to oversell it. I don't want to say tomorrow or 3 months from now, 3 years from now, but I wouldn't think 20 years.
You can find Nicholson and colleagues' paper, Tissue Reengineered Lungs for In Vivo Implantation, online at www.scienceexpress.org. Earlier this month, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration sent letters to five companies that sell genetic tests directly to consumers. The letters state that the companies have not put their genetic tests and related products through the required pre-market review, meaning that there is no independent and unbiased assessment that the genetic tests and related products are a good basis for making healthcare decisions. Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny spoke with Troy Duster about it. Duster is a sociologist at New York University and the University of California at Berkeley.
Opponents of regulation have said that consumers have a right to this information and that the genetic testing is a service that provides information and not medical diagnosis.
I see.
In fact, an executive at 23andMe, one of the companies which received the letter, said in the New York Times that any effort to deny people such information is appallingly paternalistic.
Yes.
Do you feel that people have a right to this information, even if it may not be reliable?
Well, first of all, the idea of paternalism has been used a lot in this discussion, which I think is inappropriate. For example, if you get an x-ray from your doctor, you don't say, hand me the x-ray, I'll interpret it. And if you don't, it's paternalistic. That is, you acknowledge that there's certain kinds of information which requires context and a specialist. And the same is true for genetics. I mean, the idea that you get information which is context-free, something which says that, say, you have a 20% chance of having Alzheimer's. For example, that whole idea is contextually dependent upon the reference group. And if you're not someone who knows bioinformatics statistics, you have no way of knowing what that means. This idea of paternalism assumes that the consumer knows enough about whether it's x-rays or susceptibility testing and so on to be able to have some kind of an assessment, which of course is, I think, is nonsense. The other question you raise has to do with whether or not the test is itself reliable. And this is a huge issue, but for example, we don't have any accreditation. So depending upon the company, you might get a totally different interpretation, a different percentage analysis for your susceptibility or your percent analysis for having a particular disease. So what are you supposed to do with that? I mean, are you going to go from company to company to find out what differences are? Probably not. You take one test and assume that that quote is reliable. So I think this whole notion of what I call false precision is deeply embedded in these ideas that the companies are going to give you information that's going to be, quote, reliable. Reliability and validity, of course, depending upon replication, and we don't have that. People make decisions about these matters, you know, to be life and death, whether to have mastectomy or not, and so forth. So, I mean, I think that these kinds of decisions should require context. You may remember that over 10 years ago, I was on the advisory council for the Human Genome Project, and then I was on the advisory commission for ethical, legal, social issues. It came up exactly at that point. It came up almost in this framework. To what extent should people who are going through these tests, in this case was for breast cancer, go through a protocol that required gene counseling? And we took a very strong position in those years. We said, if you're going to go through this process, you need to have a counselor who understands the larger context, not just you and the test, but you, the test, and other people, let's say thousands of people who've gone through the test, and what have their experiences been? The counselor has that kind of perspective. But if you only get the test back from a company, you have no way of knowing the larger reference population.
Do you see the sending of this letter as the beginning of a process?
Yes.
What do you think will happen next?
I think this is stage one, and I think what we're going to find in the next period are a series of answers from these companies, which will then be the basis of an FDA analysis. And they'll make the determination, probably, that this will need some much more fine-tuning. Now, I can't second-guess the FDA, but my guess is that we'll then move to stage two, which will be a much more precise determination about what will be required when they send these results back to consumers. I don't expect that the FDA is going to simply halt the testing. I don't expect that'll happen. But I think what they will do is they'll fine-tune the kinds of things which can be said when the tests go back.
Troy Duster there, speaking with Science's Barbara Jasny about the lack of an independent and unbiased assessment of the genetic tests and related products marketed by five companies, 23andMe, Navigenics, and Decode Genetics, which offer personal genome tests, Illumina, which produces a microarray used by other companies, and Nomi, which provides complete scans of an individual genome.
Shale gas has turned out to be a real success story in America.
Science's Dick Kerr reports in this week's issue on drilling for natural gas from shale rock and the environmental concerns and economic unknowns that could keep shale gas from becoming the next big fossil fuel.
Engineers have figured out how to extract this abundant but tightly held gas from shale rock almost from one side of the country to the other. It's turning out that there's lots of gas there. They can produce it abundantly, and the future is bright. But there are some specks of shadow on the horizon. There are questions remaining about how much gas is actually there, how much does it cost to get that gas out, and how is all this abundant gas going to fit into the country's energy infrastructure? And there's also emerging questions about just how acceptable this shale gas drilling is going to be to people across the country. There are environmental concerns. So people are starting to take notice of the upside and the downside of shale gas.
You said this was in America. Is there shale gas exploration going on elsewhere in the world?
There is gas in shale elsewhere in the world, Asia, China, Poland, various places. But it's the American driller who has put together the technology to make it possible, and they're way ahead of anybody else in the world.
How does it work?
Well, what drillers have come up with is combining two technologies. One is horizontal drilling. And that's when you drill straight down and then you turn the drill bit to the side and you drill horizontally. And that lets you put much greater length of well actually in the shale. And then the other technology is hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. And this technology, like horizontal drilling, had been applied elsewhere, but they perfected it for shale gas. You inject a lot of water, millions of gallons of water, very fast to give you high pressures to actually fracture the rock. You generate a cloud of fractures in the rock, and that unleashes the gas. You have to do a lot of fracturing and a lot of wells, but it does give up its gas. So it's the combination of two existing technologies applied to a fairly special situation.
With all that water going down there, you said millions of gallons of water, potentially it's mixing with the gas, right? Does that have any effect on the groundwater sources?
Well, the environmental concerns center on the water. One concern, naturally enough, is what happens when you're blasting all this water down into the deep rock, and the shale gas is below groundwater. It's below the aquifers that people draw on for their water supplies. But you are fracturing a lot of rock. Turns out fracturing up into groundwater doesn't seem to be a real problem. The concern about the water is both the volumes involved. It can be difficult to come up with that much water without putting a strain on other people's water sources. And the other concern is what to do with the water when you're finished with it. You blast it down into the rock, and most of it comes back up when you're done fracking. And that water has had chemicals added to it to facilitate the process. It can pick up natural brines, salt at depth. So you're left with those same millions of gallons of water. There are various things you can do with it. You can re-inject it into the ground. You can clean it up and put it into the local stream. Or you can clean it up and reuse it. As you might expect, not everything goes smoothly in any industrial process. And sometimes that still polluted water is spilled. Just in the last week or two, we had a blowout in Pennsylvania from a shale gas well. 16 hours of fracking water and brine and gas shooting into the air in the Pennsylvania forest. So there's community concerns about what to do with the water. There's also community concerns about this industrialization of the site, wherever it is. It can be in forested lands, as this blowout was. It can be more or less literally in somebody's backyard, as often happens around the Fort Worth area, very heavily developed shale gas in Texas.
Do these concerns lead people to take or try to take steps to prevent this kind of drilling from happening where they live?
There's a rising concern about shale gas drilling. Nobody's out waving placards in front of anybody's offices yet, but there is a response ongoing. State legislatures, state regulatory bodies. Shale gas drilling is regulated at the state level, not the federal level, with a very rare exception. So the problem, perhaps, is that this shale gas revolution is rolling into one state after another, not all of which are familiar with the ways of oil and gas industry or, understandably, this new technology. And so there are state governments, Pennsylvania, New York State, that see this coming and are probably playing some catch-up to understand it and get a handle on it.
And how long do these wells produce?
Well, it's early days. The expectation is that to be producing like 20 years. There is a distinctive, if not unique, characteristic of these wells that you might expect from the way they're produced. You crack them open and the gas gushes out, but then the gas flow drops off very quickly. A new well can have its flow decreased by 60 to 80% after its first year. So nobody's that clear on just where they go from there. So that's one aspect of the lingering uncertainty about just how abundant this new abundant resource is.
Assuming then that more and more shale gas sources will come online, will this replace any portion of oil or coal use or just make energy less expensive, at least in the United States?
Shale gas has already boosted U.S. natural gas production. And so shale gas has changed the dynamics of the situation in the U.S. How that's going to play out in the future depends on a lot of factors, the actual amount of shale gas that's down there to be retrieved and how easy it's going to be to get it out, how quickly you can get it out, and some external economic factors. But the way these things go is you produce an abundant resource – tends to push the price down. People take notice. They use more of that lower cost energy source, but they don't use any less energy. In fact, they're inclined to use more energy. So there has been a study done which points up the way this works. Shale gas will be a very positive thing for the U.S., but it's not going to automatically become a clean energy source for America unless there's some government policy which directs shale gas use in that direction. One way to intervene and direct some of this abundance toward cleaner, that is, lower greenhouse gas emission fuels, is to go the cap and trade route or a carbon tax route, things that have been much discussed. And it is contained in legislation which recently passed the U.S. House of Representatives. Shale gas, natural gas, produces 45% less carbon dioxide for the same amount of energy as coal does. So shale gas can be a bridge to a cleaner energy regime, but we're going to have to consciously direct it that way. It is not an automatic process.
Dick Kerr, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Dick Kerr reports in this week's issue on drilling for natural gas from shale rock and the environmental concerns and economic unknowns that could keep shale gas from becoming the next big fossil fuel. Now, David Grimm, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how chimpanzees kill for land. So scientists have figured out a motive for these killings?
Yeah, exactly. Scientists have actually known for decades that chimps kill each other. Ever since the mid-1980s, when Jane Goodall and some of her colleagues were observing chimps, they would see occasionally chimps kill each other, and it was unclear why they were killing each other. There was some speculation that they might be killing each other for resources or land, but it was really hard to show because a lot of these chimps had interactions with humans, and that was a confounding factor because you didn't know if this interaction with humans might somehow be influencing the chimp's behavior. So in this new study, which actually took place over the past decade, researchers observed chimps, but they really kept their hands off. They observed these chimps from afar and really tried to stay out of their business. And they were specifically observing male chimpanzees of a group called the Ngogo group. And this is a group of chimps in Uganda's Kibali National Park. And what the researchers observed is they also observed these chimps killing each other. And what specifically they saw is every couple of weeks, the males in this Ngogo group would form these patrols of several males. And these patrols would go out through the forest, and they would occasionally hear the sound of a solitary chimpanzee in a neighboring territory. And when they heard this, they would advance toward this chimpanzee and kill it. And this chimpanzee was usually an infant, although not always. And first of all, the researchers observed the killing. But what they observed after the killing was that these Ngogo chimps would move into the killed chimp's territory. So they seemed to be using killing as a way to add more land to their territory.
What do they get out of the additional land?
Well, it's kind of unclear. Researchers have speculated that they may get access to more resources, things like fruit trees, or even other females. If there's too many males, they might want to add more females to their ranks. And a way to do that is to kill off males of a neighboring group, move into that territory, and acquire the females, as it were.
Have researchers witnessed this?
Well, researchers actually haven't seen this happening with an Ngogo group. They said that no females from the vanquished group have joined the Ngogo group so far. So it may be as simple as the fact that the Ngogo group has a lot of males and that they just have enough numbers to really exert their force over these neighboring territories. And they may just be doing this to increase the size and the strength of their community, as humans have done over the millennia.
So this data is only looking at this one particular tribe?
That's what the researchers looked at in this study. But based on this work, it's possible this is actually happening elsewhere as well.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from short chimps to tall people, this next story is all about the genetics of height. What makes some people taller than others? Well, researchers have suspected that it has something to do with our genes, just like pretty much everything else about us. But it turns out, up to now, researchers have only found 5% of the genes responsible for the height differences between people. And this isn't just restricted to height. In fact, a lot of traits and a lot of diseases, which researchers thought, you know, there must only be one or two big genes for these diseases, researchers are actually finding that for a lot of these conditions, there doesn't seem to be these big genes out there. So there's been two camps. One camp says, these genes are out there. We're just not using sophisticated enough technology to find them. And we really got to ramp up our technology to find them. But another group says there are no more big genes out there for a lot of these conditions. There's just a bunch of really small pieces of DNA that account for these differences. And we really haven't been looking for them.
So nurture or environment rather than nature or genes?
No, actually what the researchers are saying is that the differences are, at least in this study, what they're saying is that these differences are really chalked up to very tiny changes in DNA, something called single nucleotide polymorphisms. And these are essentially single letters of DNA that vary from person to person. So whereas, Rob, I might have an A in a certain position on a gene, you might have a T there instead. And that's very tiny difference out of billions of letters of DNA could make the difference between you being a foot taller than I am, Rob. And researchers have actually looked at these SNPs, as they're called, for a variety of conditions. And they found occasionally that certain SNPs seem to correlate with certain conditions. But this team is arguing that you can't just look at these SNPs individually. You actually have to look at them in aggregate. And if you look at them, a lot of them together, you'll start to find a lot more of a correlation between small changes in DNA and potentially big differences in things like the difference between height in two people.
So what was the data for this study?
Well, what the researchers did was they focused on height, and they looked at height across a subset of the British population, and they tested 300,000 of these SNPs in each member of the population. So they're looking at an enormous number of these SNPs. And what they found was when they did this, they found that they could actually find a correlation between these large numbers of SNPs and height. In fact, they say they could explain 45% of the variation in height between people by just looking at these SNPs.
So before they were at 5%, now they're at 45%.
Exactly. And actually, height is only thought to be about 80% heritable. So they're more than halfway there in explaining the genetics of height, and definitely a lot further than we were before.
So the next step then is not necessarily to figure out more about height, but maybe to apply this same sort of thinking towards other conditions, diseases even?
Exactly. There's a number of other diseases like diabetes and heart disease and schizophrenia, which researchers all think have a strong genetic component. But again, they haven't found these big genes out there that explain these conditions. And this team is arguing we'll go back and look at these tiny changes, but don't just look at the tiny changes by themselves. Look at a lot of these tiny changes in aggregate and see if when you add up a lot of these tiny changes, if they help explain some of these other conditions.
So a new way of looking at old data.
Exactly.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from genes hiding in plain sight to a signal for space weather hiding in X-ray noise.
First, what is space weather?
Well, Rob, when a lot of people talk about space weather, they're talking about the solar wind. This is a flow of particles that's essentially emanating from the sun that spreads out into the solar system and specifically can impact the atmosphere of Earth. When you have things like solar flares, which are these ejections from the sun, they can actually disrupt really important communications equipment, satellites, a lot of stuff that drives our technology today. And right now, scientists don't have a really good way of predicting space weather. It's not like meteorological weather where you can say, you know, on Wednesday, the sun is going to do this. It's much more difficult to figure out exactly what the sun is doing. And also, even if you've had a problem with the satellite, engineers often don't know right away, you know, was that just a malfunction, or was it something that was caused by space weather? So this new study is all about, can we find a better way to monitor space weather?
And they're looking at X-ray noise?
Exactly. The discovery actually came about quite by accident, as happens with a lot of scientific discoveries. Astronomers using what's called the XMM Newton spacecraft, which is this craft that's out there looking for things like stars being born and black holes. The astronomers noticed that a lot of the images that the spacecraft was taking had the equivalent of sort of being overexposed or being grainy. They had this sort of noise in them, and the researchers couldn't figure out what that was. They took a closer look, and what they found is that when comets approach the sun, the solar wind generates low-energy X-rays when its charged particles hit neutral atoms in the tail of these comets. And what that does is it causes this X-ray distortion, which the researchers were picking up in their images. Well, that's only the first part of the story. Once the researchers realized that, they said, you know what? The solar wind is hitting the magnetosphere of Earth all the time. This is this almost like this protective bubble that shields Earth from solar radiation. And they said, you know, the same thing is happening. These low energy X-rays are being generated when the solar wind is hitting the magnetosphere. Can we image these X-rays being generated as the solar wind hits the magnetosphere and essentially create this map of Earth's magnetosphere? And that would tell us what's going on with the solar wind and hence space weather.
What kind of resolution then are they getting with this kind of thing? Is it basically just, okay, that was a solar flare, that wasn't a solar flare, so if something has malfunctioned, you just know what to look for?
That's exactly right. What they're suggesting is that we put a lot more technology into detecting these low energy X-rays. We really don't have a lot to detect them right now. And if we do, we can create this map. But even this map of the magnetosphere is really not going to help us predict what's going to happen with space weather. But it will tell us, say, a communication satellite all of a sudden goes on the fritz. You know, right now, if that happens, engineers spend a lot of precious time figuring out, okay, what happened? Was it space weather? Was it a malfunction? Was it something else? And depending on what happens, determines how they're going to fix it. But with a real-time map of the magnetosphere, researchers could say right away, okay, we just saw that there was a solar flare there, or there was some intense space weather near this satellite, and now we know what the cause was, and that's going to help us know how to fix it a lot quicker.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, speaking of astronomy, we've got a story about how one alien world is experiencing winds of 7,000 kilometers an hour because of the way it's positioned near its sun. And also a story about how you can blame your tan or lack thereof on natural selection. And on Science's policy blog, Science Insider, we continue our extensive oil coverage. We've got a new story about how researchers might be able to use sonar to track oil plumes underwater. And also a story about quack stem cell therapies. These are clinics that are popping up around the world that promise to cure everything from cancer to blindness by injecting you with stem cells. And the scientific community is fighting back by publishing a list of a lot of these illegitimate stem cell centers so that patients will be better informed. And you can check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a June 4th letter in response to the March 19th policy forum, China, India, and the Environment. In that policy forum, Bawa and colleagues propose that cooperation between the world's two most populous countries will be vital for mitigating biodiversity loss, global warming, and deforestation. Kelvin Peh writes in from the University of Cambridge to call into doubt whether Sino-Indian cooperation is best developed by concentrating on these two nations alone.
Peh writes, Bawa et al. Proceed from the assumption that the military presence of China and India along their disputed border is damaging the Himalayan ecosystems. However, the authors have overlooked the possibility that, as perverse as it may seem, the fact that the Himalayan region is heavily militarized may actually protect its key habitats and rich biodiversity because the area is not available for economic exploitation.
Peh concludes, China's impact on the environment extends much farther than India. Beijing's interest in gaining access to Africa's raw materials presents a far more urgent cause for concern. To mix a sensitive territorial dispute with environmental efforts is a recipe for paralysis. At least for the moment, the Himalayas can wait. The world cannot.
You can read the full letter in the June 4th issue of Science. Our next letter is also from that issue and is in response to the April 9th News of the Week story titled NSF Board Draws Flak for Dropping Evolution from Indicators. In that story, news writer Udijit Bhattacharjee reports that the 2010 edition of the National Science Foundation's biennial compilation of the State of Global Science omits any mention of two findings that appeared in past surveys of scientific literacy.
The omitted findings? That Americans are less likely than people in the rest of the world to believe that humans evolved from earlier species. And that the universe began with a big bang. Bhattacharjee quoted Louis Lanzerotti, chair of the board's Science and Engineering Indicators Committee, as saying that the questions about evolution and the Big Bang were flawed indicators of scientific knowledge because the responses conflated knowledge and beliefs.
Where is the conflation? Asked letter writers Joseph McInerney of the National Coalition of Health Professional Education in Genetics and Michael Doherty of the American Society of Human Genetics. The authors continue, the statements to which the survey respondents reacted are correct. One either knows that or does not. Would the NSF Science Board see conflation of knowledge and beliefs if 55% of the public responded incorrectly to the statement, smallpox is caused by a virus, because those respondents believe the disease is caused by demonic possession? Or would the board see those responses for what they truly represent, an outdated and impoverished understanding of the natural world?
When facts conflict with beliefs, the authors conclude, it is the beliefs that must give way. The scientific community should not recoil from strong support of the scientific facts, nor should scientific bodies refrain from sharing data that reveal that much of the public does not understand central facts about the world and the universe in which we live.
Our last letter is also from the June 4th issue and comes in response to the special section on science, language, and literacy in the April 23rd issue. Joanne O'Connell-Whitney writes in from the University of California, San Francisco, to point out that the issue addresses the challenge of reading scientific papers, yet the articles in this section illustrate the very problem they discuss.
Whitney writes, "Consider the long sentences and the number of brackets, parentheses, commas, and dashes in the second paragraph of C.E. Snow's perspective. It is apparent why even scientists only read papers in their own field. Collectively, the sentences in each paper almost need to be diagrammed in order to be understood. I particularly like how P. Vandenbroek found it necessary to insert two sets of parentheses in the abstract of his paper."
You can find Whitney's letter in the June 4th issue of Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the June 25th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.